Hello and welcome to The Blockchain and Us, where pioneers and thought leaders talk about their journey in blockchain technology, crypto assets, and the token economy. And I'm your host, Manuel Staggers. This episode has support from my very own The Blockchain and Us newsletter. Get an email from me every 2 weeks with a very short summary of new podcast episodes so you can immediately pick those interviews you'd like to listen to. To stay up to date, just visit www.theblockchainandus.com and sign up today. My guest today is Don Tapscott, one of the leading authorities on the impact of technology on business and society. Don is the author of 16 books, including Blockchain Revolution, which he wrote together with his son, Alex Tapscott. In 2017, Don and Alex co-founded the Blockchain Research Institute, where they have been working on over 70 projects to date that investigate blockchain strategy, use cases, implementation challenges, and organizational transformations. Don is a member of the Order of Canada and is ranked the second most influential management thinker in the world by Thinkers 50. He is an adjunct professor at INSEAD and chancellor of Trent University in Ontario. And now to the conversation with Don Tapscott. Hi, Don, and many thanks for taking time today.
I'm happy to be here.
I'd like to first speak about your book, Blockchain Revolution. You and your son Alex wrote this book in 2016 and updated it just a few months ago with new material. Now, if you look at the blockchain and crypto space today, how does this match up with what you describe in the book?
Well, we decided to do a new edition to the book because there have been a lot of new developments. And normally you go through and you rewrite the book. But when we read the book, everything was really solid. So we decided rather than changing it, we'd just write a big forward, a new forward. It's big. It's 25,000 words. It's like almost a small book. But and we picked a few topics where we thought it was worthwhile updating. One was crypto assets, because we felt that there was a lot of confusion around that. Everyone views these as digital currencies, but of course, currencies are just one type. We also picked up again on the theme of identity and the notion of a self-sovereign identity. And there's a lot of confusion around that, because people think it's just identification, or people think that the way to handle privacy today is through, you know, GDPR or some kind of government legislation. We think there are much more profound ways of dealing with it. We picked up a bit on the social contract, a very big idea. We also talked about the issue that had really emerged in the last 2 years about where's the global center for all of this going to be. Now, it won't just be one place, but the Silicon Valley of the second era of the internet will probably not be Silicon Valley. So there's a big opportunity for countries everywhere, and regions everywhere, to build a new blockchain ecosystem. So, but the book continues to be a bestseller. It's in, I don't know, it's like almost 20 languages. It's right now, it's a bestseller in 5 Asian languages.
And, that's cool.
And I'm very proud of it.
I just wanted to ask, what kind of feedback are you still getting about the book today?
Well, it holds up very well. And the feedback is enormously positive. One of the biggest things about the new edition is that we explained that what is represented by digital currencies is not just that there's an underlying technology, blockchain, that represents an internet of value, but more that the old, well, Bitcoin bad, blockchain good paradigm that everyone used to talk about, it's not really a valid one, because digital assets are a part of building a new business model on a blockchain. So yeah, you can have cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin, and there's a role for those if you're in a country like Venezuela where there are restrictions over capital flows. And Bitcoin is also a store of value, and it goes up, it goes down. If you bought it a year ago, you're up. If you bought it 6 months ago, you're down. But that's one of what we said are 7 types of digital assets. We have we now have platforms where something like Ethereum or Icon or soon Cosmos, you know, Aeon, Polkadot, these kinds of things. The token is not fundamentally a currency. It's really a token that enables the platform to work and that enables smart contracts to function. You've got crypto securities, which we think will be the biggest category, all securities, not just stocks, but bonds and swaps and futures and you name it, will become digital. And you can see this in a, you know, you have a big ICO of hundreds of millions of dollars. That's not venture capital. That's real money. That's investment banking. But there's no investment bank. There's no stock market and there's no stock. And that kind of is the writing on the wall there. And they are securities. They should be regulated. But then you have things like natural asset tokens that can represent a barrel of oil, or they could represent a you know, a synthetic asset like a carbon credit. I'm involved in CarbonX.ca, and we're attempting to tokenize carbon credits, so ultimately to mobilize billions of people through economic incentives to behave differently. So it goes on and on. You know, you have stable coins, you have crypto collectibles that could never have existed before because of the double spend problem, and digital fiat currencies. And I think next year, in 2019, we're going to see a bunch of countries that will actually move seriously in this direction. So there are many different types of these tokens, and we really want people to understand this. Regulators should understand this because they look at a token, they say it's a duck. But it, if it doesn't look like a duck, walk like a duck, and quack like a duck, it may not be a duck. And if it looks more like a dolphin and it makes a squeaking sound, it might be something different. So, and it's the same thing within the enterprise. You need to develop a strategy whereby physical assets that exist today, this is the biggest transformation of those into digital ever. And this is really a big deal, and it's not just about investing, it's about the transformation of the firm.
I mean, you've been writing about technology since the 80s. And
unbelievably so.
Yeah. How many books?
16.
16 books, yeah, fantastic.
Well, I wrote two books in the 80s that nobody read, so they don't count.
Now, when you look at what blockchain technology does, do you think that's a market difference there, a paradigm shift, or is it more something that, you know, just builds on previous innovations?
No, I think it is a new paradigm. And, you know, the way that we position it in the book and at the Blockchain Research Institute is for 40 years, we've had an Internet of Information, a native digital medium for information, digital. But, you know, if I send you some information, a copy of this podcast, I'm actually sending you a copy. I retain the original. And that works great for information that's not an asset. But when it comes to assets, things of value, like, for example, a podcast or, you know, money or stocks or securities or intellectual property, the data in our identities, loyalty points, carbon credits, cultural assets like art and music, votes and assets, something of value that belongs to somebody, a lottery ticket. I spoke last week in Argentina at the World Lottery Association. Copying those is a really bad idea. You don't want someone copying your identity or your vote. And if I send you €1,000, it's important. I still don't have the money. So this is, you know, cryptographers have called this a double spend problem. The way that we manage that is through intermediaries. And they have a lot of problems, growing problems these days. And so what if there were a native digital medium for value? You know, what if there were an internet of value where anything of value could be managed, stored, transacted, dealt with in a secure and private way, and where trust was not achieved by a middleman, but by cryptography and some code, you know, some clever code? That's what it represents. So thanks for using the word paradigm. I do, as you may remember, have some culpability in popularization of that term, my 1992 book, Paradigm Shift, although I didn't invent the word, the concept came from a book in the 60s called The Structure of Scientific Revolutions that I happened to run across. And I just applied it to business. But a paradigm is a mental model, and they put boundaries around what we think, and they constrain our actions. They're often based on assumptions that are so strong that we don't know that they're there. You know, the Earth is at the center of the universe. That was a paradigm for millennia. The big problem in the world is communism. The purpose of computing is to automate existing business processes with the goal of reducing headcount. Money is something that governments create. Stocks are the way that we understand equity in a company, and they're managed through things like stock exchanges. And, you know, something can happen in art, science, culture, technology, whatever, that causes a shift to occur, and that's what we have right now. And that's why there's so much, I don't know, cynicism? Because when you get a new paradigm, these things cause dislocation, disruption. They're often received with coolness or worse, hostility. Vested interests fight against change. And it always happens that leaders of old paradigms have great difficulty embracing the new. So is Western Union going to invent the new paradigm in global FX and in funds transfer, for example, for the global diaspora? I don't know. I don't think so. Why would they move towards something where you're transferring money from Toronto to from a housekeeper in Toronto to her mom in Manila? She's currently paying 10%. Why would you do that for 1.5%? So it's this old problem of cannibalizing your existing revenue, and leaders of old paradigms just having the greatest problems sort of understanding a new one.
Mm-hmm. But this time around, you know, when you look at what this internet of value, what that proposition is of the future, that, you know, basically that this technology paints of a more peer-to-peer, more empowered society where, you know, many people can actually do what a huge company was necessary for before on their own with just code. How realistic do you think it is that these big players, these incumbents that are around today, even have a business, you know, in a few years?
Well, that was the kind of question that we would pose in 1994 about the Internet of Information, and it had a big impact. You know, the digital economy, I said, 94, there's this thing called disintermediation, and the flip side called reintermediation. If you're in the middle, you're probably in trouble. But you can create new value. You can re-intermediate. Bookstores are between readers and publishers. Barnes & Noble will probably be hit hard, I said. But something new could come up in the middle that would be even bigger. Now, Amazon had not been incorporated when I said that, but that's what happened. So, you know, what from an investment point of view, what are you going to invest in? 94, we got these great companies. You got Kodak, you got Barnes & Noble, you got
Blockbuster.
Blockbuster. You got Nortel, it's killing it on voice communications. And, you know, so we have a similar situation today. I see companies like FedEx today that have absolutely the potential to do this because they have the kind of leadership through Fred Smith and people there like Rob Carter, the legendary CIO, and they are all over this blockchain thing, wondering if this can enable them to once again reinvent the whole logistics industry. But you look at others, it's less likely. In general, I don't predict this stuff. I mean, we're of the view that the future is not something to be predicted. It's sort of something to be achieved. So I'll talk to anybody and say, you can achieve a new future, and here's some ideas on how to do it. But you get a lot of resistance still.
Yeah, definitely. One thing I notice is that people always think it's the other guy that's going to be disrupted. For example, look at universities. Mm-hmm. Many of them are now coming up with some kind of interdisciplinary blockchain classes, and they think they're safe. But in the future, I believe many students will not need a university. Or then you have software developers who focus on blockchain engineering, solidity programming, token engineering. But in the future, it's very likely that an AI will do all of this.
Well, we'll see. I mean, you know, the big disruptors today are prime candidates for being disrupted. Way back in 2016, the original book, we talked about Uber or Airbnb that are really service aggregators. You know, it's wrong to call them sharing economy companies. They don't share, really. This is successful because they don't share. How they could be replaced by a set of distributed apps, smart contracts, and maybe some autonomous agents on a blockchain. Because blockchain does everything, pretty much, that the company does. All of the identification, you know, the database, find a good room, find a driver. All the contracting, you do that through smart contracts. All the payments be handled on a blockchain. All the reputation stuff, all the logistics. I mean, this is all can be done through software. So, and, you know, the big juggernauts of the internet age, something like Facebook, I mean, this is an existential question for them. They're part of the world of digital feudal landlords. You know, under feudalism, you worked the land and you did all, created this value, and then you gave it away to the landlord and you got to keep a few cabbages. Well, today we work the land, you know, we work the digital world and we create this new asset class called data. We create it, but they take it away and we get left with a few cabbages too. And that means we can't use this data to plan our lives. We can't monetize the data. And you have this massive digital conglomerates creating all this wealth. And there's a bifurcation of wealth today that's growing. So that's a big problem. It's what's behind all the populism and craziness going on. And it means our privacy is being undermined. And people who say privacy is dead, I think that's stupid. Privacy is the foundation of freedom. And all of this data constitutes our identity, so we need to get it back. And the way to do that is not to give us access to data or to control their use of our data like the GDPR. I mean, there's a role for government legislation. The way to do that is to own our own data. You know, we should have a sovereign identity and that's portable on a blockchain that's sweeping up all of this transactional data, health data, locational data, educational data, and so on. And then we decide who's going to get access to that data. Maybe we want to monetize some of it. And this is a very different paradigm. So obviously something like that is a big threat to a company like Facebook because at least its current business model, because its current business model is being a feudal landlord.
Do you think Facebook will be around in a few years?
Facebook has a lot of install base and a lot of users and a lot of people all around the world, in particular in the developing world, that, you know, will still come onto it and use it. And Facebook as a company also owns, you know, a couple of its biggest competitors, Instagram and WhatsApp. But, you know, as soon as there's a social network that enables me to own my data, I'm just as a user, I would love something like that. And, you know, we're now at the BRI, we're working with government leaders, and I've actually met with some heads of state recently. And about this idea of a self-sovereign identity, and that's a very powerful thing that could really change the game, not just for Facebook, but for everybody. You mentioned the university. Imagine when your student record is part of this identity. Not just the fact that you got a B on biology 101, but what your prof said or your lab instructor said about your seventh lab, you know, micro credentials attested to by the university, and you know the provenance of the identity. Information. So you now have a portable educational record. Maybe it also includes all of what you did in extracurricular and includes all kinds of, you know, part-time job stuff and internship stuff and all the rest. So maybe we will see the sort of disaggregation of these institutions of higher education, where you have a student-focused model of learning, and your educational identity is part of this, and it moves around with you. And maybe you decide you want to do your AI at Stanford, and your geology at MIT, and you decide you want to do your English literature from Oxford, and so on. That's not unthinkable.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Sounds great. Would be great if that existed. The last time we spoke was about a year ago. And then you were quite concerned. And you said that on balance, the effects of the internet have been negative. So has that view changed?
Well, there have been all kinds of wonderful things, obviously. You know, we have Wikipedia. I'm now a grandparent. I can FaceTime with my one-year-old grandchild, and there are many, many wonderful things. But the main dangers that I said might happen 25 years ago have all come to be true. I said we could see a bifurcation of wealth. I said we could see our data being captured by a small handful of companies and governments and the undermining of our privacy. I said we could see technology come in so fast that it would disrupt labor markets permanently and create structural unemployment. Now, that hasn't happened yet, although...
Well, it depends where, I think. In many areas it has happened.
Yeah, when you think about Donald Trump and the wiping out of the Rust Belt, that wasn't caused by Mexicans or even outsourcing or Canadians. It was caused by technology, 92% of it. So, and then you've got this next wave that's coming along, 48 of 50 states. Number one job type for men is truck drivers. The number one job type for women is a cashier. And then this is coming fully into knowledge work too. So you combine AI and blockchain, and this is a powerful tool for prosperity and entrepreneurship. But I think ultimately, the idea of a job is going to come into question. So, but there are other, you know, the fragmentation of social discourse. I thought the internet would bring us all together. I said it could go the other way, and it has. You know, we can all follow our own point of view, and we're in these little self-reinforcing echo chambers. I think the purpose of information is not to inform a lot of us, it's to give us comfort for our preconceived views. These are three or four of a set of nine kind of big structural changes. And I think we are going to need some kind of new social contract as we go forward. And I've just launched on LinkedIn a discussion about this. And I've got, you know, a lot of followers on LinkedIn. There's like close to a million. And I hope it's a robust discussion. There's one university already where the prof has assigned the students to participate in the discussion as part of their coursework. So just look me up on LinkedIn and join in on the conversation.
To summarize maybe your vision of this new social contract, what do you think a social contract for the digital age should look like?
Well, the foundation is a self-sovereign identity for citizens where we own our data. Secondly, I think the idea of a job, there's lots to be done. And, you know, there's lots of controversy around a universal basic income. You know, we're going to need that. If half of the population can't work, you can't let them starve. But to me, the programmatic position that makes more sense is that everyone should have the right to a job. And if the jobs can't be provided by the private sector, then we need, as part of a contract, to find out new ways through philanthropy, through the civil service, through stimulation of entrepreneurship, and through putting things in the commons. There are more things that governments could do. Now, I know that's not a popular thing to say, but there's nothing wrong with government per se. There's just something wrong with bureaucracy, and there's also something wrong with corrupt politicians. And I don't mean corrupt that they're getting a bag full of cash. I mean corrupt in the sense that the way that they act is to meet the interests of their funders rather than, you know, the electorate that voted them. So, you think about all the big challenges that we have around climate change and poverty and many, many big global problems. And people get satisfaction out of work. So I don't view some kind of welfare state where we're all, or leisure society, which was absurd, where we're all sitting around, you know, I don't know what we're doing, eating jelly beans and watching TV and going for, you know, lying around the pool. We need to enable people to be productive. I think that we do need to make some big changes to our basic institutions like democracy, because there's a crisis of legitimacy right now of democracy. And again, this technology, blockchain, can help. We could have smart votes. We can have electronic voting, finally, now. I think we're getting really close to that. But we could move away from citizens being passive and inert to more of a culture of public deliberation and active citizenship, and representatives who are accountable to the electorate. So these are some of the big themes that I think that we need to sort through. I'm the last person in the world to say I got this all figured out. It's kind of complicated. But we need to start to have a discussion, and that's my goal. I've actually drafted a first draft of the social contract. I'm sure it'll be like a dartboard, but I don't care. It won't be the first time in my life I've had darts thrown at me.
Mm-hmm. How do you get young people, very young people, you know, maybe teenagers or even younger, involved in this discussion? Because I don't see them in this conversation.
Well, it's easy to blame the young people for the fact that a lot of them aren't voting, but I put the blame more on our politicians and the fact that they've set up systems that make it tough for people to participate. Young people should vote, absolutely, and they did in the last U.S. election in the midterm. It was youth and women that sort of got the Democrats another 40 seats. But I mean, we should be having these conversations in a structural way in the schools. I think every year kids should have to attend a course or partial course on media literacy, where they think about, they learn to have good BS detectors, and where they learn how to manage their time and how to handle the information overload. And they learn about things like the importance of reading an entire article. And because how are we going to inform ourselves as a society when the old ways of doing that are collapsing? We need to do this in a deliberate and conscious way, and it starts with young people, and it starts in the schools. So that would be a big step forward.
Mm-hmm. Cool. You know, another thing I'm quite concerned about in this whole blockchain and crypto space is the capture by people who are mostly interested in sales and marketing, who are male and quite gray already. Mm-hmm. Do you think this could be a problem for the future of this space?
Well, that's historically been a problem in the, technology industry. It's been a tough industry for women. I have a niece, rock star in computer science. She dropped out in her fourth year because the culture of all these guys and the kind of harassment that she was getting was just too awkward and too difficult for her. So there's much to be done. But I'll tell you, there's a lot of good progress on a lot of fronts, making the world more inclusive. And I think that the objective forces for change are unstoppable. You know, the more diverse societies tend to perform better. More diverse companies tend to perform better. The Me Too movement, I mean, that's just an expression that women are not prepared anymore to be, assaulted or to be you know, taken advantage of in the workplace or anywhere else. We've got the fact that a lot of talent in the world is not old white guys. You know, we've got these juggernauts that are appearing around the world, China being Exhibit A, but also, you know, great computer science and great engineering and so on from many other countries, India and so on. So, I mean, this is just going to happen because there's nothing so powerful as a force whose time has come.
Yeah, maybe it's just going to take a little bit more time. Don, what are you still learning today?
Oh, man, my head hurts every day. And it starts with my morning Google alert on blockchain. And there are 15 things there, and I have heard of two of them. And I'm like, are you kidding me? Is that going on? Is that going on? People are doing that. That's extraordinary. At the Blockchain Research Institute, we're working with all these really big brains. I'll just give you an example. I got asked to give a talk on how blockchain reinvents marketing. I had some ideas, and then I realized we're doing a big project on this. A guy named Jeremy Epstein. I went and read his report, and it was like, that's unbelievable. You know, that blockchain is going to change the way you think about the size of a market. It's going to bring about all kinds of new price discovery mechanisms. The whole concept of the brand, which is about trust, will be transformed because you can evidence that you're trustworthy, that your food is safe, or that your diamonds, you know, are not conflict diamonds. You know, and there are seven different ways that blockchain is transforming marketing. So it made my head hurt reading that paper, but I ended up giving a hell of a good speech. Then and the stuff that no one had ever heard before. So I think it's very stimulating for me to be surrounded by the smart people and by young people. One of the smartest being my son, Alex, who's every time I talk to him, it's like, or hear him give a speech, I'm like taking notes. So I suppose I should be retiring or slowing down one of these days, but I seem to be speeding up. I don't know how that all ends. But I was telling my agent, one of these days I should stop traveling so much, giving all these speeches. And he said, come on, Don, 85 is the new 50. So I'm a long way from 85, but...
That's great. If you look back at your career and all the things you've done, the books you've written, the projects you worked on, is there anything if you could do it over again, that you'd do differently?
Well, I would have invested in some of these companies I said are going to be amazing. We did a report in early 95 on new price discovery models, and we figured it was going to start with auctions. And I said to my team, there's got to be an auction somewhere on the internet. And they found one. It was called Auction Web. And we wrote it up and we said, this is going to be really big. It's going to change price discovery. Buyers have more knowledge and power. They have this way of syndicating trust in the community. It's called the feedback forum. We published the report. A couple of months later, the project manager came to me and he says, you're not going to believe this, but they just changed their name. And I'm like, oh, okay, fine. Republish the report. What's the new name? He says eBay. And it was after that. I'm pretty sure it was after that that Jeff Skolins invested $70,000.
Amazing.
And so he's got, $4 or $5 billion. But I have a really great report. So as the song says, money can't buy you happiness, but it can buy you a boat.
Cool. How much longer do you think we'll be speaking about blockchain technology, or when will, you know, the next thing come up?
Well, the Internet of Information, I've been kind of talking about this for 40 years, and I think this one's good for 40, probably longer, because it's messing with deeper things. You know, the deep structure and architecture of the corporation, how we orchestrate capability really to innovate, to create goods and services. It's messing with the whole financial system, you know, this $1 trillion Rube Goldberg machine that no one can comprehend. It's messing with things like money. So that's going to go on for quite a while, I think. It'll take various twists and turns, and the really big thing that'll happen is AI will become distributed on blockchain. So when you have AI meets blockchain, all bets are off on everything, and that's starting to happen.
Cool. Sounds like a new book in the making.
Probably a podcast series.
Yeah, excellent. Well, I'd be happy to be involved there. Don, this was great. Thanks a lot for taking time.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us today. More info on our guests and our sponsors is in the show notes of this episode and on the podcast website, theblockchainandus.com. To help people find this podcast, it's important that you download, subscribe, and give it a top rating and review on iTunes or on the podcast platform of your choice. I'm Manuel Staggers, and I thank you very much for listening.